As you turn in your Bibles to Psalm 3, during this month of Thanksgiving, I'm working through some of the Psalms. The Psalms were Israel's hymnal. Now, some of you young people that are in here don't know what a hymnal is. You're saying, what's a hymnal? Because whenever we sing hymns, it's up here on the screen. But way back when Brian Carr was a young man, there were these books that would be there in front of the seat, in the seat in front of you. And those books had songs in them, and we called that a hymnal. Well, Israel's form of that was the Psalms, and they would sing these Psalms. By the way, even to this present day, there are groups of Christians, many of them are Presbyterian brothers, who do not sing the choruses that we sing or even some of the hymns that we sing. There are some groups that will sing or chant hymns or psalms. Psalms were a major part of the Christian worship for centuries, and we do well not to forget the psalms. There's a poetry, a vividness to the language in the Psalms. As we looked last week, we talked about Psalm 2, where the heathen rage and they plot against God, but God just kind of does what his sovereign will and plan call for in spite of the rebellion and resistance of the people of the earth. Now in Psalm 3, Psalm 3 is the first of the Psalms, as we have them, that is actually ascribed to David in its very title. Psalm 2, tells us, was a Psalm of David. But in Psalm 3, even in the very title that you see there in at the beginning of the Psalm, it's listed as a Psalm of David, when he fled from his son Absalom. Now, I'm going to start by reminding you of what was going on during this time. Remember who Absalom was. David had sinned with Bathsheba, and after his sin with Bathsheba, God had told him through the prophet Nathan that there would be trouble that would come to his house. Some of this is about to get to be PG-13, so understand this. One of David's sons, in this polygamist family that they had, one of his sons had an inappropriate relationship with his half sister named Tamar. Tamar's brother was a man by the name of Absalom. Absalom plotted revenge, and after a number of months, even years had passed, Absalom invited all the sons of David, all of his half-siblings and full-siblings, to a feast. David refused to come. He was too busy with the administrative work of the kingdom. But during that dinner, Absalom had hired assassins ready, and they murdered the guilty brother. Absalom, because of his part, runs away. He hides in a separate neighboring kingdom for 2 years. And then but David, throughout the time, is missing Absalom, and he's dejected. And finally, David's right-hand man, his go-getter, David's fixer, named Joab, Joab is an interesting character in the Bible. Joab, by the end, is not in David's favor, and you're going to see why in just a moment. But Joab, time and time again, takes up for David. He over and over has David's back. But Joab says, David, why don't you just bring Absalom back? He even arranges a strange story that he hires a woman to make up a story to be like a parable to convince David that it's appropriate to bring Absalom back. And after much persuasion, finally David allows Absalom to come back into the kingdom. But David does not go to see Absalom because, you know, the polls said that would be politically incorrect. After all, Absalom had been his brother's murderer. Absalom, though, insists, and eventually David and Absalom see one another face to face. But after that meeting, nothing was ever the same. David loved Absalom, but David was distracted and busy with the affairs of the kingdom and not paying attention what was happening in the heart or in the life of Absalom. Absalom, for his part, was an ambitious young man. He knew that based on what he had done previously, he would never ascend to the throne by his father's blessing. And so slowly over time, manipulating the people, Absalom set up shop outside the government buildings there. He would meet the people in the mornings. You know how people will gather in the morning and people of a certain age will congregate and they'll talk about all the problems that are going on in the world. They'll read their newspaper and then they'll have diner wisdom to share with one another. Well, if I was the president, here's what I would do. If I were the king, here's what I would do. If I were the head of Tennessee Department of Transportation, here's the road I would fix. You know, that I usually see it at Hardee's. So Absalom set up at McDonald's, and he would listen to people. He'd say, "You know, you got a good point. I see what if there was just someone who could speak on your behalf. What about you, Absalom? You know, I'm not that kind of guy. I'm not a politician." And slowly he begins to subvert his father's name among the people. In 2 Samuel 15, 16, 17, which tells us the story, the phrase is, Absalom stole the heart of the people. And then his plan comes to its culmination, and he stages a coup. And as he walks in, even some of David's brightest and most trusted advisors are found to be part of Absalom's attempted coup. David realizes what is happening. And before they can assassinate David or any of the major players in David's administration, that they leave town. They leave town so that they would not be assassinated. Absalom and his men come in. David even left some of his concubines and wives there at the palace to take care of things. Absalom goes into them in an inappropriate relationship, thereby showing the people, I am making my claim. I am now the king. I am taking over in place of my father David. one of the advisors comes to Absalom and says, you need to go after David and you need to do it right now. You need to get him while he's off balance. You need to get him while he's not ready for you. But God, in his infinite wisdom, had placed one of David's friends in Absalom's court. And his friend named Hushai. I might try to get one of my children to name one of my grandchildren Hushai. Can you imagine that he comes up to bat, little league? Let's go, Hushai! I say, but Hushai speaks to Absalom. He says, oh, no, no, you don't want to. This advisor, Ahithophel's advice is not good here. You need to wait and gather all your army, make sure you got all your ducks in a row, and then go after your servant, your father David. And in God's movement, Absalom takes Hushai's advice, and all the while, Hushai is trying to buy David some time. David has run from his own son. David, a hero of Israel, now king of Israel, is running, not from the Philistines, not from Saul. David is running from his own son. And it is in the context of that night, knowing that his son is gathering an army to come to assault him, that David writes what we now call Psalm 3. Let's look at the text. I'm going to read the psalm in its entirety here. Psalm 3, O Lord, how many are my foes? As you read it, feel the distress that David has. It's not just the number of enemies, it's the people who are my enemies, even my own son. Lord, how many of my foes, many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. I want you to see some things here in these stanzas that are right here, four stanzas. The first one identifies the problem that he has with opposition. David's opposition can be summarized. He uses the word many three times in verse one. Many are my foes. So he has many enemies. Many are rising against me. They are aggressive enemies. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him and God. They are slanderous enemies. Just think about the kind of opposition that he's facing here. You have, just numerically, you're outnumbered. 1,000 to 1. Maybe it wasn't 1,000 to 1, but it feels like that. It feels like everywhere you turn, someone's against you. If we were speaking in the polling data that we use today, his approval rating, David's approval rating, what was in the tank right now. People were upset with him. Maybe the economy's not going as well as they wanted it to. This David, who was a hero at one point, is now seen to have flaws. He seemed to be imperfect. Maybe at times he doesn't seem to know what he's doing. People have ideas that it could be done better. But as Absalom and his men have gathered around and they have subverted David's administration, can you imagine that at some point, you see there in verse 1 where it says, there is no salvation for him in God? It's not that the accuser is necessarily saying there is no God. Now, we know that we will sometimes have opposition from people who don't believe in God. But these opponents, his son included, and Ahithophel, one of his most trusted advisors, these people would say there is no help for him in God. Why? Not because there is no God, but because God's on our side. And it further darkens David's mood to that the enemy, they're not claiming to be standing against him and God. They're claiming that God's on their side. And then there's David, worried, embarrassed, humiliated. His own son has run him out of town. His own son is having an inappropriate relationship for everyone to see, as was the custom of that day, with women that were in David's harem. Now, how are we going to respond against opposition? Our opposition may be different than what David was facing. Of course it isn't. We may say, oh, you're kings and queens, but we mean that in a figurative sense. To my knowledge, none of you are actually kings and queens. You don't tithe like it. I take it that nobody is actually of royal descent. Hey, when your name's Outlaw, you know that. I don't know, we do have opposition, though, don't we? And there are times where the problems of life just weigh down on you, and you're not... It comes time to sleep and you just can't get your mind to stop going and going about all the problems that you're facing. You have many enemies. They're aggressive and they're slanderous. How do you sleep at a night like that? How is David supposed to sleep in a cave in a field, outside of a field, where he's running from his own son? That's what this psalm is about. I guess you could say call this psalm spiritual Ambien, because it helps us to understand how a man like David, experiencing that kind of opposition, can sleep because of God's sovereign power and work on his life. As we consider David's reaction to opposition, I want you to see a threefold reaction and to mark it down as your path to good sleep. Number one, in verses three and four, the first response to opposition is prayer to God. Prayer to God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. As we talk about God's prayer to God, I want to invert because of the crescendo that I want to build here. I want you to look at verse 4 to begin with. I cried aloud to the Lord and he answered me. There's a slide that I wanted to put up here, but I didn't get around, get it to mark. One of the great influential shows of the late 60s just really set my understanding of the fight between good and evil. It was Batman. Y'all remember that one? Hey, the kids now, that they've seen the Christian Bale, the Dark Knight Rises, that kind of stuff. That's not Batman. Adam West. That's Batman. You remember? Pow! Zowie! And you know, just, you know, in the commissioner's office, there was a red phone. Y'all remember that? It was the Bat phone. And whenever they needed Batman, they would pick up the red phone and Batman would answer. Have you ever wanted to try to get a hold of somebody? Maybe it's a friend of some importance. Maybe it's a friend that's a businessman or maybe mayor or somebody like that. And you call them and they just don't answer. And you realize, I'm not all that important to them. I'll tell you a story about one of our friends here. Very dear to our church family now is Anthony Sweat, Corey, as you may know him. And in a moment of tenderness, as he was talking to me about how much the church meant to him, he said, "When I call you, you answer the phone." You know how much that means to people, that you take their calls? Think about that in prayer. It's one thing to say there is a God and that I offer up my prayers to God. But what the psalmist is saying is, I cried to God and he heard. He heard my prayer. I said, "Lord, my wife is going to surgery on Wednesday, and he hears me." And not only does he hear, but this God of the universe takes the time to answer us. Ronnie says, "Lord, Lacey's got a doctor's appointment." God hears him. When you say, "Lord, there's this thing happening in me," God, the God, not just a God, the God of the universe hears us. He answers. I also want you to notice about his response to our prayer. Not only does he answer us, he defends us. He uses three images here to talk about God's defense of David. He's a shield about me. Now, that idea of the God being a shield is nothing new. This is not an isolated text in the scripture. In Genesis 15, as Abraham is approaching the Lord, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. And God is speaking to Abraham here, and he says, "Fear not, Abraham, I am your shield." God had called Abraham away from his family. And it's in the family unit that back then, in that agrarian society, it was in the family unit that you would find safety and protection and resources. God's called him away from the rest of the family to be on his own, going to a city that God would show him. And as he's going, God promises him, saying, "Abraham, don't fear. I am your shield." In Deuteronomy, speaking of the people of Israel, this is a passage, by the way, that I always think of the one sermon that I heard from this passage preached by the man who would have been my father-in-law, Floyd Wolfenbarger. Now, y'all think the name Outlaw is weird? Angie's maiden name was Wolfenbarger. It was a step up, you know. That's but her dad preached a sermon from Deuteronomy 33:29. "Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help, and the sword of your triumph. Your enemies shall come fawning to you, and you shall tread upon their backs." And then, exemplary of the rest of the Psalms, not only here, but also in Psalm 33:20, the psalmist writes, "Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield." Now, these are just examples of the many places where God is referred to as our shield. I want to comment to you, though, as you face opposition, a shield is useful to you against the enemy that you face. If you run and turn your back, shields don't help that much. God is our shield, is a very present help in time of trouble. But that help is for us to face the enemy, to face the opposition, not to run from it. As he defends us, he is our shield, he is our glory. The word glory there is not the idea, "Oh, look at me, tell me how good I am." I remember Bob Costas was commenting, he was doing the commentation on a football game one time, and one of the players, he caught a touchdown pass, he spikes the ball, and this is way before the Tim Tebow days, but he does his little prayer, crosses himself, and he comes up and does all this with the fans. And Bob Costas says, as he's commentating on the replay, he says, "And then he bows in prayer and rises to be worshiped." and that's how a lot of us are. "Lord, I want your help so that I can be worshiped." God doesn't do that. God is not in the business of making other gods. God, when we speak of glory, God is the one to receive the glory. When he says, "You are my glory," that means you're the one at the core of how I define myself. That's what it means. In Luke as Simeon sees the baby Jesus that he had been promised that he would get to see. He says, "Now your servant may depart in peace. I have seen your salvation. He is a light of the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel." What he's saying there is, our identity as a people was to bring forth this baby. That was our identity. That was our purpose. God, you are my glory. God, you are my identity. You are my purpose. When I go to work, when I go to school, I'm not identified by my record. I want to be identified as belonging to you. You're a shield about me, my glory. And then one of those tender images in the Psalms. You are the lifter of my head. I have to be careful here because even my words can muddle the vividness, the clarity of that word picture. How has the Lord been to you the lifter of your head? We bow our head when we're ashamed of ourselves, when we're depressed, when we're defeated, when we're shamed. And it is God in his grace, love, and mercy that works his sovereign hand under our shameful chin and lifts us to look at the glory of his face. He encourages us. He encourages us by reminding us that no matter how much we messed up, we belong to him. I imagine in the story that Jesus told of the prodigal son, as the prodigal comes back and bows himself before his father, that the father works his hands underneath the chin of his son and lifts his face to see him and says, "You're my son." The lifter of my head. How has God lifted your head? Sin that you have committed, that God has said, "I've taken care of it." Plans that you had that they just shattered. Relationships that didn't work out. Pain that you felt, and God lifts your head to say, "As much as it hurts, you need to know I am still here and I am in control." Step one to good sleep, prayer to God. Step two is confidence in God. In view of his prayer to God, David says, "I lay down and slept." You say, "Well, that seems simple." But you have had those nights, undoubtedly, where as simple as sleep sounds, it just doesn't come. You lay down and you toss and you turn. I've had it where sleep came fine for me in the beginning, and then the person that I won't name gets in bed with me, and she wants to talk about something. And she, and I try to keep sleeping. She keeps moving, and finally I wake. Hey, honey, what's wrong? Again, not naming any names, and then she unloads. Here's this thing that has happened. Maybe it's something I did. Usually something I did or didn't do. And this happened. And because of that, this happened. And she goes on like 10 minutes. And so I start to respond. And in mid-sentence, she's gone. She's asleep. And now I can't go to sleep. Well, sleep sometimes just doesn't come. There's trouble, and David's saying, I've prayed to the God of the universe. He heard me. He's defending me. I can go to sleep. Think about the sleep that he's describing. He's describing, as he's running from his son, sleep. He's in the cave, perhaps. Critters around. Hyenas and coyotes calling off in the distance, and David sleeps. That's because he has confidence in God. He has prayer to God, but he has confidence in God. And because of that confidence, he can lay down and sleep. This picture that's here is a Norman Rockwell portrait. And he did a series called the Freedom Series. They're freedom from want and various things. But this one is called Freedom from Hunger, or Freedom from Fear. Freedom from fear, you can see the children being tucked in. Mom's tucking them in. There's not a care in the world that those children face as they lay their heads down to sleep. In the foreground, you see in the left hand of the father a newspaper. What you can't see from this distance is the headline of the newspaper, which talks about the bombings of World War II. The children are oblivious to the danger around them and in the world because they feel safe in their father's care. As David slept, and as we are told to sleep, the sleep comes deep and well because we are in our Father's care and we have confidence in Him. We trust Him. And because of that confidence, because of that trust, we sleep well. But not only do we sleep well, verse 6, I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. There's still a battle to be fought. David has confidence in God, but David still has swords to swing and arrows to shoot. You say, how do those active solutions, such as battle plans and the passive solutions, trusting in God, how do those work together? I don't always know. I do know that I trust in God, and then I do what I'm supposed to do. There's an old African proverb that my boss, Clint Morgan, always would quote to me, to all of us around him. He would say, trust God, but tie your camel. What was it Reagan used to say, trust but verify? It's not that you doubt God. It's that as you trust him, there's work you got to do. You say, well, are you saying God's not sorry? Of course God is in control. He's sovereign. But he expects us to do what we're supposed to do. How that works on a philosophical and theological grid, I'm not always sure how to plot that out, but I know that if there's a battle to be fought, you better bring your weapon. David's got a battle to fight against his son's army, and there are battle plans to be drawn up. There are swords to be sharpened. There are arrows to be packed. There are positions to be gained. And they're going to talk about all those strategies. But David's ultimate confidence is not in his archers. It is not in his generals. Joab, sharp as he may be, David's confidence is in God. For us as a church family, we have a lot of work to do. We're down in our numbers, and we're not going to get our numbers up by just sitting here and hoping people come. There's stuff that we got to do. There are people that we have to invite. And as those people come, there are phone calls that we got to make. There are people that we got to minister to. There's a lot of work to be done. Growing a church is hard work, folks. But in the end, as this church grows, it is not because of our efforts. It is because of God's gracious blessing. I don't know how all that all fits together, but I know that all of those things are true. As you face health problems, trust God for healing and go to the doctor. As an enemy comes, or as an intruder comes into your house, pray to God for safety and reach for your weapon. I don't know how it all fits together, but I know it does. Confidence in God. And then not only is there prayer to God, confidence in God, but there's also dependence on God. Verses 7 and 8. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Now, at the end, that you see this word Selah, and it occurs at the end of verse 8, it occurs at the end of verse 4, it occurs at the end of verse 2. We're not really sure what Selah means. Various people will offer things like it means kind of like a Hebrew amen, or now hear this. To tell you the truth, linguistically, we're not sure, because they use it in different ways at different times, and so we're not positive what it means. But there's some kind of way in which it brings attention to what has just been said. And this is the third time that he uses it in the psalm. He is expressing here dependence on God. And you see in the first couple of lines of this verse 7, he is asking God, pleading to God for his own salvation. Then he's asking, we speak of psalms, precatory psalms, where David or another psalmist is asking God to exercise bodily harm on his enemies. Now, in some ways, our 21st century American sensibilities don't bode well with that. We've somehow taken our idea of Christianity to mean that everybody's supposed to be okay. Lord, take care of my enemy, put him safe in his bed, far, far away from me. That was a line, by the way, in Fiddler on the Roof. They asked this Jewish community, they asked their rabbi, is there a blessing for the Tsar? The Tsar, the leader of Russia that was oppressing them. And the rabbi said, oh, yes, there's a blessing for the Tsar. May God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us. But the psalmist is very realistic, and he says, Lord, break the teeth of my enemy. And in other passages, he says, break their right arm. Lord, I don't really don't care what you do with the enemy. Just get him off my back. If you want to save him, fine. If you want to kill him, I'm not going to be all that distraught about it. But that's what David is saying. Because David knows there's a battle that's about to happen. And they're not going to come and just debate. They're going to come with swords and arrows and spears. And David asks not only for his own salvation, but he asks for the destruction of his enemy. Now, we're in that odd position now as ambassadors of Christ in this world, where we are asking for the enemy to become, by God's power, the children of God. But ultimately, we seek for the ultimate enemy, the devil, to be absolutely, utterly, and eternally destroyed. So, Lord, save me, destroy my enemy. And then the third plea there is a plea for glory. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Save me, destroy the enemy, and get the glory. There are battle plans to be made. There are business plans to be developed. There are life skills and life plans to be executed. So there's work for us to do. But we must trust in God by praying to Him, by having confidence in Him, and ultimately and fully having dependence on Him. Having done those things, we can sleep well, knowing that He is in control.